Hello again, and welcome to Wall Street Macroeconomics. I'm really curious to know where people are logging in from, so if you give me some feedback on that, I'd be happy to see it. Oh, we have someone from Venice, Toronto, wonderful. New York, where I teach at Pace University. Halifax, which I visited this summer on a cruise, which is beautiful. Port Huron. Okay, thank you. So we have many people from many different areas, and I'm very pleased to see that. Let me start with saying something that might seem strange at first, and that is that in the strict sense of the definition, there really is no such thing as Austrian macroeconomics. So we can all go home now. No, but in fact, as I'll explain during the lecture, there is a way to interpret macroeconomics so that an Austrian can give a perspective on it, okay? But macroeconomics itself was not developed as some sort of an Austrian discipline, so as we'll see as the lecture goes on. And Danny just shifted my perspective, thank you. So let's start with a little background. The founder of macroeconomics was actually not John Maynard Keynes, as most people would claim. It was actually John Law, who was a gambler. He was a convicted murderer. He killed a man in a duel. I didn't put this in here, but he's also a financial scammer worthy of Bernie Madoff. And he was the first central banker. He took over the Royal Bank of France in 1760. And then promptly destroyed the French currency. But he wrote a very interesting book in 1705 when he was trying to get the first Scotland and England to listen to his proposals for curing the various illnesses that he saw with the economy of England and Scotland. And the book was called Money and Trade Considered, with a proposal for supplying the nation with money. So right away, you know there's something wrong. That is, right in the title, he's telling you that money's a cure-all, okay? That money's going to cure whatever ails an economy. He didn't get a sympathetic hearing in Great Britain, so he left and went to France, and as I said, eventually became the central banker. One of his statements that he made, which sort of sums up, in a way, macroeconomics as it was originally conceived, is that money limits trade and employment. Trade depends on money. A greater quantity employs more people than a lesser quantity. And he goes on and finishes up saying, nor can more people be set to work without more money to circulate so as to pay the wages of a greater number. So this, in sum and substance, is modern macroeconomics. And Law was the first one to develop a consistent set of doctrines, although they were wrong-headed, that could be called macroeconomic. And let me just go through a few of these, and you'll recognize them. I mean, if you read what Bernanke has to say, what Greenspan tells us, if you've taken conventional macroeconomics courses, all the doctrines in modern macroeconomics were actually first expounded by Law. So, for example, and I won't put it in his words, I put it here in my words, I'm paraphrasing him. He says that the volume of the supply of money determines the total amount of production and employment in the economy. Okay? So, in other words, there's a causality there. Money creates wealth. He also points out that money is not valuable in itself, but is merely a claim to goods. It's like simply a ticket, okay, that gives you a right to exchange goods for that ticket. But the ticket itself isn't valuable. Okay? Well, of course, we know that's not true, as Austrians, right? Because and as simply citizens that are aware of our own situations, I mean, people do not spend their complete paychecks. In other words, people will hold a great deal of money, and they value that money. They abstain from buying things, and instead choose to hold money in the form of cash or in the form of checking account balances. So that in itself tells us, as Austrians, that people are demonstrating that money has a value in and of itself. That when you refrain from buying a restaurant meal on a given night and you hold the money instead, that you value that money more than the restaurant meal. He also said, and of course all macroeconomists fear hoarding like a vampire fears sunlight. He said that hoarding is irrational. That is, simply holding money or more money than John Law thinks you should be holding, or Bernanke or John Maynard Keynes. So it's irrational, it destroys wealth, income, and jobs. So here we see the central doctrine of macroeconomics, that spending that drives the economy, that creates wealth and jobs. And let's just a few others of Law's views. He claims that prices are sticky downward, meaning that if people demand less of certain goods, if they demand fewer iPads, well, the Apple cannot easily lower the price of iPads. He doesn't really give any reason for that, of course. But of course, Apple slashed its price of iPads as competitors came into the market. And your local car dealer, at the end of a model year, has what's called leftovers on his lot. And they're all below sticker price, the original sticker prices on the cars. And many of them, in the case of models that do not sell, are actually below the cost of production. So for Austrians, this is a nonsensical position. Prices are not sticky downward. There's other ways of cutting prices. Instead of actually cutting the price itself, they can give discounts. They can give no-interest loans. Restaurants will alter the amount of food that they give you in a given meal, make it smaller if they want to raise the price, or larger if they want to lower the price per unit of food. So entrepreneurs are very ingenious, and they're able to change prices to respond to changes in supply and demand. But even today, macroeconomists deny this. Their whole position really rests on the fact that prices are sticky downward. Because if people hoarded money and didn't buy goods, and prices weren't sticky, there wouldn't be any problem, right? I mean, prices would fall, and all the goods would still be sold, right? People's wages would adjust downward. Prices would adjust downward. With lower prices and wages, there'd be no difference in the purchasing power of money, okay? So now, if all prices were cut in half and your wages were cut in half, for example, you would still buy the same amount. So if you went from $10,000 to $5,000 a month in your wages, but prices were cut in half, you woke up the next day, prices were half as high, your real income wouldn't change. Your standard of living wouldn't change. Law also said that low interest rates are investments, okay, and that if there's too little money in the economy, if there's scarcity of money in the economy, it results in high interest rates, and that discourages investment spending. So basically, he believed, like modern Keynesians, that the interest rate is the price of money. But of course, the interest rate is not the price of money. The price of money consists of all the things that you can buy with a dollar. So the price of a dollar is one bottle of water. A bottle of water is a dollar per bottle. We'll get into this. Or it could be one one-thousandth of a high-definition television set if it costs $1,000. And going on, he believed, of course, as all macroeconomists do, that gold and silver were unstable in value, that they fluctuated too much to be used as a good medium of exchange. So he didn't believe they were suitable to serve as money, and he also said that they were too expensive. And of course, and this is back in 1705, when almost everybody believed that gold and silver should be money, he's one of the first to enunciate the doctrine that that paper fiat money should replace gold and silver. Let me go to the next slide now. Now, Law was the founder of macroeconomics, and in fact, there were a lot of what were called monetary cranks during the 18th and 19th centuries. And classical economists, starting with an economist who was sort of a proto-Austrian named Cantillon, were the first ones to respond to Law, and another French economist named Turgot, and then David Hume and Adam Smith, though he had some of Law's fallacies in his theory of money, they all responded. And by the early 19th century, the British bullionists, they were called, they were hard money, sort of proto-Austrian, pro-gold standard economists like David Ricardo and John Wheatley and a number of others, they had all established classical monetary theory, which for the most part was the correct theory. And all of the people that believed in paper money believed that gold and silver shouldn't be money, believed that prices were sticky. They lost out in a very early debate in the early 19th century. And after that, they just became monetary cranks. They were looked down upon. They weren't considered to be economists, and so on. And that existed throughout the 19th century, okay, until in the late 19th century, there was a debate over whether silver should also be made money alongside gold. That is to have the government begin printing paper money, the U.S. government, it's called bimetallism, and buying up silver to inflate the money supply to drive prices of agricultural products up higher. And that's when we had the first quantity theorists, they were called. At least they were mechanical quantity theorists. And the first person to really come up with an equation that represented sort of modern macroeconomics, again, it was not John Maynard Keynes. It was Irving Fisher, who's known, who wrote The Purchasing Power of Money 1 year before von Mises wrote his great theory of money and credit. And Milton Friedman considered him the greatest American economist to ever live, okay? And Fisher was a strange guy. He was a health nut. He was a prohibitionist. He was strongly in favor of prohibiting alcohol. He was in favor of the movement that outlawed alcohol in 1919. He campaigned for it. He campaigned for a lot of public health measures and so on. And he also was a health nut. And also a price stabilizer. He believed that if the Federal Reserve, which had come into existence in 1913, was able to stabilize the value of money, that is to keep the price level basically stable, we would get rid of all inflations and recessions, and the economy would operate at its optimal level. And he wrote this book called The Purchasing Power of Money, in which he expounded that doctrine, but he gave it a theoretical basis. And we'll get to the equation that he used, just as an example of what modern macroeconomics is like in a moment. He was the one who, in the 1920s, I mean, he was by the 1920s, he was considered probably the greatest American economist living at that time. And in the 1920s, he saw that the price levels hadn't changed, that consumer prices were about the same, that wholesale prices were falling a little bit, and so by the end of the 1920s. He proclaimed that we were living in an era of new prosperity, a new era of prosperity. And he claimed that from now on, there would be no longer be depressions because the Fed had understood and was able to execute a plan to stabilize prices. And of course, a year or two after he said that, we had the Great Depression, and we had the stock market collapse in the Great Depression. He lost his wife's substantial fortune in the Great Depression. Okay, and in the 1930s, he kept saying that prosperity was right around the corner and not to worry about it. Okay, he's probably telling that to his wife more than anyone else. But of course, it dragged on until World War II. Let me go to the next slide here. Okay, now the most famous 20th century macroeconomist, though he wasn't really the founder of macroeconomics, so I stress, though you'll find in all modern textbooks that he's considered founder of macroeconomics. In fact, as I said, in the case of modern macroeconomics, it was Irving Fisher. So Keynes wrote The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, which was published in 1936. It was an immediate hit. He counseled governments to simply increase deficit spending, add spending to the economy because spending had fallen off. People were holding more money rather than spending it. That is, in Keynes' book, they were hoarding, which is a very, very bad and evil thing to do. And so government had to step in and offset this. Keynes had a very interesting and strange life, and you can I highly recommend Murray Rothbard's Keynes the Man for details on his life and his career. Well, let's look at what these two modern macroeconomists said. Okay, the essence of macroeconomics, both with John Law, with Keynes and Fisher, and today, is twofold. One, that spending drives prices, production, income, and employment. In other words, the more you spend, okay, the more production we'll have, more income we'll have, the higher prices will become. Now, the people who follow Fisher are known as monetarists, okay, and then it was really Milton Friedman who rehabilitated Fisher's reputation, and they tend to stress more that prices will rise as a result of spending, though they also believe in the short run you can give a boost to production and income. And the Keynesians, on the other hand, believe that if we're in a, as we usually are in a recession, or if we're growing below our potential, okay, sometimes they call it an output gap. It might not be a recession, but we're still not growing as fast as we could be. In that case, if you increase the money supply or increase spending in some other way through deficits, then you're going to get an increase in production, income, and employment. Prices will not rise until you've had full employment, according to the Keynesians. Okay, and by the way, with the financial crisis, the modern Keynesians, they're called the new Keynesians, who began to become more monetarist in the 1980s and 90s, now have gone back to Keynes. Okay, now they're just simply, old Keynesianism has come back with a vengeance. All they want to do is just spend more. They want a massive amount of government spending. And now the second part of, or the second element of the essence of macroeconomics is that economic activity is determined not by the actions of individuals, like consumers, producers, entrepreneurs, buyers and sellers, but by what we call economic aggregates, okay, by the amount of the money supply, by what we'll see is called velocity, and so on. So the actions of human beings, though they claim that they underlie these aggregates, are sort of forgotten about, and you have a very, very mechanical view of how the economy operates. So let me just give you a little bit of a feel for that mechanical view. Okay. So here's what I call the holy equations of macroeconomics. First, we'll deal with the one that Fisher put forth. And what he said was that the value of money can easily be explained. Okay, there's a certain supply of money in the economy at any given moment in time, and he included cash and didn't quite want to include checking accounts, even though he did say that they're sort of money. It was only a year later that Mises pointed out that checking accounts were no different than the cash that you hold, that they were a medium of exchange, they operated in the same way, they had the same result if you increased them. So there's always a supply of money in the economy. The Austrians would agree on that. And then he said, well, every dollar in the economy, or the average dollar in the economy, is turned over a certain number of times. So I put in some figures here. Let's say we have $100 in our little model economy, and on average, a dollar is spent 5 times during the course of the year. Now, some dollars may not be spent at all. They might have zero velocity. People might hold them in the cookie jars under their mattresses and so on. Other dollars may turn over 20, 30 times, but the average dollar turned over 5 times. So that means then that there's $500 of spending in the economy. Okay, $100 times the velocity of 5. So $500 is spent in that year. On the other hand, let's say the output in the economy, now Fisher used the word T, the letter T for transactions, which includes not just newly produced goods and services in that year, but also includes all sorts of financial transactions, the purchase of antiques and used goods. Economists have now filtered all those out, and they use Y, which simply stands for the total amount of goods and services produced in that year. So we'll use M times V equals P times Y. So let's assume that the average pizza is $10, okay, so that and that the economy produces 50 pizzas. So this is just an equation. It's an identity. It has to be equal, right? I mean, if people spend $500, there has to be $500 spent on in total on pizzas. So the total income in the economy of the producers of pizzas, including the workers, if that's the only good in the economy, is $500. It can't be one penny different from total spending. And that's a truism. You know, no one would, an Austrian would not dispute that. It's simply the significance that we would disagree with. So what Fisher said is that the quantity theory, not just the equation, but the theory said that spending will determine, so I use that little arrow going to the right, facing right, determines or causes total income. Total income is P times Y. Okay, Y is only the real income, the total amount of goods and services. Okay, so to get total money income, you have to multiply it by the average price. And there's all sorts of problems with coming up with these sort of aggregates. Okay, the only aggregate there that really exists in the real world is M. There is a total amount of money right now at this moment. If you added up all, we could determine our own money supply. Adding my money supply to all the participants in this course, that is the amount of cash they hold and the amount they have in their bank accounts. Certainly, let's say the American participants, their dollar holdings. We would come up with a real figure, okay, which would be meaningful. But velocity is a fake figure. I mean, what is velocity? It simply says this. Look, if you can... If you see that $500 is being spent in the economy, well, let's put it this way, that there's $500 of spending, right? Well, then, if there's 50 pieces and there's only $10 a piece, well, you can find, Laura, let's look at this, let's step back a moment. Let's say there's only $100 in the economy, okay? So forget about V for a moment. And there's fifty pizzas at $10 each. So there's $500 of spending in the year, but only $100. So all they do to figure out velocity, it's not independent of anything. They take the $500 in income that was earned by selling the pizzas, and they divide it by the $100 of money that is in the economy at any moment in time, and they say, well, that must mean that each dollar turned over 5 times to buy $500 worth of pizzas with only $100. And also, as I'll show you, the whole idea of spending causing prices is wrong. So what Fisher would say here is that with the quantity theory, Fisher and most monetarists believe that V is more or less stable over time. It only changes very slowly with financial innovations. So if people use more credit cards, for example, in the 1950s, when credit cards were introduced in the United States, you would expect people not to want to hold as much money, so then velocity would tend to go up. People would spend cash faster, the amount of cash in the economy, because they don't have to hold as much. So they spend more of their income. Why? Because they can walk around with credit cards and use the credit cards to pay. Okay. Or ATM machines. They can put their money into savings accounts, which let's assume are not part of the money supply, and then they know that at any time they need to write a check or they need to take money out, they can simply go and get it from their savings accounts. Okay, so let's go on to, so that's sort of the background for Fisher. And let me just go to Keynes now. And then we'll go to the Austrians. Okay, now Keynes had a different equation. He focused more, he thought the prices were sticky, so he didn't have prices in his equation. On the left side, he had Y, which stands for the same thing, the total amount of output in the economy during the year, let's say. And then he broke up into three parts different kinds of spending. C stood for consumption. I stood for investment spending. Now, investment spending in the form of buying new factories, machines, research and development, software programs, not an investment in the sense of putting your money into a financial asset, okay? So that in macroeconomics, investment only means buying goods and services, that is capital goods and land. And finally, government spending was added in, okay? So on the one hand, on the right side, that's your total spending, or Keynesians call it expenditure, but it's the same thing as M times V, it's the total spending in the economy. And that spending, when it goes up, will cause real income to go up, okay, unless you have full employment. That is, when people spend more, according to Keynes, wherever it comes from, including government, suddenly sellers, producers see that the amount their inventories begin to run down. They're selling goods faster. They're starting to run out of goods when people's spending goes up. So they order more from manufacturers. Manufacturers then need to put more workers or hire more workers. You have more jobs. The workers produce more. You have more production. So you have more Y. So according to the Keynesians, Y is equal to and determined by, if you look at the theory below, C plus I plus G determines Y, determined by spending. Okay. So on the other hand, at some point, Keynes believed, and the Keynesians believed, expenditure can be so great, it can increase the spending so much that when the manufacturers, producers try to hire more workers, there aren't any more. You're at full employment. So the only thing they can do, instead of increasing their production, is that they can raise their prices. So money doesn't directly affect prices at all. Okay. In fact, it's very, very circuitous. Money will push the interest rate down, and at lower interest rates, more will be borrowed. People will spend more on houses and investment. That will increase expenditure, and eventually you'll have greater Y, and only if you have full employment will you have prices rise. So Keynesians don't worry at all about, or don't worry much about inflation, okay? The monetarists worry a little bit more about it. Okay. Now that's the last slide that I have. But what I want to do now is talk a little bit more about the Austrians. And let me just point out some Austrian critiques of sort of this mechanical approach to macroeconomics. First of all, the Austrians point out that spending, okay, even if we take the monetarists, who are more rational than the Keynesians, because they do claim that an increase in the money supply will increase prices. But again, they believe that when you increase the money supply, you also, with given the velocity, if you have that equation, M times V, so spending will increase. So let's say you increase the money supply, if I can go back here, and I don't know if I can, to the previous slide. I can't go back, but let me just put it, change shift to the whiteboard, see if I can write here on the whiteboard. Let me just get a pencil. So, for example, I'm not going to be drawing very well here, but bear with me. So, if the money supply is 100, okay, so we have 100. Okay, this is 100, and the money supply doubles, and yet we have only, let's say, velocity is 5. So if you double the amount of money from 100 to 200, and velocity remains at 5, each average dollar will circulate, will turn over 5 times during the year, you'll now have $1,000 of spending instead of $500 of spending. And since the monetarists believe that Y is pretty stable, that Y depends on things that are a little bit different, that is, that depends on technology and the amount of labor and so on in the economy. Then what's going to happen is that prices will increase. Okay, so the amount of money in the economy and spending will drive prices. But now let's look at it from the Austrian point of view. From the Austrian point of view, prices are the main thing that determine production, that determine even spending in the economy. Prices come first. So as the Austrians would point out, if you've taken Peter Klein's micro course, that it's people's value scales, okay, how they rank money and different goods, that determine what prices are. Okay, so let's say I make a deal with a babysitter to come to my house and babysit my child for $10 per hour for $20 per week. Okay, so the price is there's an equilibrium price for her services, $10, and there's a quantity that she supply, 20 hours of babysitting time in that week. Okay, now that there's been a price, we've struck a deal. She then produces, so it's production and exchange that will result. So she produces 10 hours of baby or 20 hours of babysitting services. I pay her $10 per hour, and as a result of that, I hand over to her $200, and she provides me with the services. Okay, where was the spending? The spending didn't determine the price. Okay, the price and the amount of hours that she was willing to work at that price determined how much I had to spend. So this is one problem with all mechanical macroeconomics. That is that spending does not determine prices. Prices determine spending. So another example might be, I just happened to notice that Kobe Bryant is the highest paid basketball player in the NBA this year. I scribbled down a figure here. He's making almost $31 million this year. So he plays 82 games. He provides his services over the course of 82 games. He gets paid after every game, I believe, or maybe they get paid every week or every 2 weeks. But he provides the services, and he gets paid that salary. Okay, that's the price. Okay, so his total income is $30 million because whatever his rate is per game, I didn't figure it out, but that rate times the 82 games, okay, that price that has been agreed upon, then determines that the owners, in exchange for his services that he gives to them, has to give him $30 billion or $30 million. So the point being, I mean, this is it seems trivial, but it's an important point. Point being that for Austrians, that it's prices that are the key to the economy, okay, whether it's microeconomics or macroeconomics. And total spending, if you add up all the amount of money that is spent in the economy, is totally meaningless. Right? It's individual prices that are meaningful. And as these prices change with relation to one another, we then get changes in the makeup of production. We get changes in how labor is allocated and so on. So here what we can do is we can transition into talking a little bit about what Austrian macroeconomics is. So given that the Austrians reject the essence of macroeconomics, that is, first, that spending drives the economy, spending determines production, employment, income, and so on. And secondly, that I guess we call them macroeconomic aggregates, okay, like velocity, like the price level, the P that I drew there, like Y, which is the sort of overall amount of goods and services produced in the economy, which is, of course, it's impossible to add up because you can't add Apple iPads, and you can't add oranges of fruit plus, let's say, automobiles. I mean, as has been pointed out by Murray Rothbard and others, I mean, there's no way to come up with this Y that's meaningful. Okay, so we reject both of those things. The whole idea of spending being central to the economy and the idea that you can analyze the economy without directly referring to the actions of individuals. So then how can Austrians have macroeconomics? What does macroeconomics mean to an Austrian economist? Well, let's think a moment. Macroeconomics doesn't have to refer to macro aggregates. It can refer, in a very loose sense, to the economy as a whole. And is there anything in the economy that appears in every market? Okay. So if we take all individual markets, is there something common about all those markets? And in fact, one thing that we know that is common to all of those markets is that money is one half of every exchange, right? Okay. So money is involved in every exchange. There's hardly any border in modern economies. So that leads us to the conclusion that what happens to money, what happens to the supply of and demand or demand for money, is going to affect every market in the economy. So for the Austrian, then, one of the elements of macroeconomics, if you want to call it that, is money. Okay, so Austrians focus on the theory of money and the problems with that develops in the monetary sphere as a macroeconomic topic. Okay. So that's one of the key topics in Austrian economics. And so from going from there then, banking becomes very important. It becomes a macro topic. Okay, it's involved in the production of money, which again affects all markets. The central bank, of course, becomes very, very important to Austrians as a macroeconomic topic for the same reasons. Because the central bank is really the only organization that can legally print money up out of thin air. Okay, they don't actually print money. I mean, Bernanke used that phrase. He denied that the central bank actually printed money when he was on the 2020. He was interviewed on 2020 in that terrible interview that he gave, where he was extremely nervous and could tell that he really didn't want to be there and didn't want this transparency, didn't want to talk to the public. But in any case, he made the statement that, oh, no, the central bank doesn't print money. Well, in fact, it doesn't print money. What it actually does do is simply create money in cyberspace by a keystroke. I work at Pace University in New York City, three blocks away from where the New York Fed is, and every day between 9 and 11 a.m., there's something called Fed time, in which the Fed bids to buy from 30 privileged banks and bond dealers, government securities, treasury securities, and also now, of course, mortgage-backed securities. I think they buy $85 billion per month. Now, how do they actually buy those securities? Very simple. They simply create a credit. So if a bank sells $2 million worth of securities, the Fed simply, via a keystroke, creates a $2 million credit in the bank's reserves, which are mainly held at the Fed. So that gives the bank the right to loan out those $2 million of reserves. Once those reserves are loaned out, the money supply increases by $2 million, okay? But the borrower then spends that money, and once the money's spent, some of it is redeposited in the next bank, which now has more reserves, and that can go on up to a maximum of each dollar of reserves that the Fed creates on that day. Within 2 or 3 weeks, it could cause a tenfold increase. So for every dollar could cause a maximum of $10 of new money to come into existence, every dollar of reserves. So the Fed is extremely important to Austrians. And then there's another element, and another phenomenon that's very important in all markets in the economy. And that is the interest rate. The interest rate affects almost all exchanges, okay? Even if you buy a consumer's good, if it's a durable consumer's good, like a house or an appliance or an automobile, the interest rate comes into establishing the price of that house and the automobile and so on. The higher interest rates are, the lower the houses of these durable goods will be. And certainly that is the case. The interest rate enters into all transactions between capitalists. So if GM buys steel from a steel firm, then the interest rate will determine if that price is higher or lower. And the further away from consumers the capital goods are, the more sensitive they are, their prices are to the changes in the interest rate. So once again, the interest rate is involved in almost all markets in the economy. And again, banks are central to what's happening to the interest rate. Okay? They don't determine it, but they can influence it, and certainly the central bank can influence it. Okay? The interest rate is determined, like all other prices, on people's value scales, how much they value present goods, that is consumption today, to consumption in the future. Okay? The more that people prefer consumption to the future relative to today, the more they're willing to save, and we're going to go through all of this in more detail during the course. And therefore, the more savings you have, the more voluntary savings you have, the lower the natural interest rate will be, that is, the market equilibrium interest rate will be. And the more money will be available for investment in productive capital goods, and therefore labor productivity will be raised, and the economy will grow, okay, if you use that term. But if that interest rate is artificially pushed down because the Fed has created let's say, a given day, $1 billion new dollars of reserves, which have then been loaned out and created even more money, you'll then find that in order for the banks to loan out those new reserves, okay, they'll have to get more people willing to borrow. And in order to do that, they have to lower interest rates. So there's another fallacy you should keep in mind, which we'll come back to. The Fed does not determine interest rates. Okay? The Fed does not set interest rates. Okay? The Fed creates money, okay, through open market operations, the buying and selling, the buying of securities from banks. And it's that activity which will then influence the interest rate. But if the Fed doesn't recreate that, doesn't continue to produce and create more money, the interest rate will go back up to the market level. So to keep the interest rate down near zero, the short-term interest rate, as the Fed is doing, they don't just set it there. They have to keep continually pumping money in and beating it down to zero, okay, or to near zero. So we're gonna be dealing with the interest rate, okay, and what we call the structure of production in the economy. Okay? That is how capital goods, how labor and capital goods are transformed over time into the final consumer's goods. So we have now money and interest rates. Those two things affect the economy. But there's a third thing that affects all markets in the economy, and sometimes called the business cycle, the boom-bust cycle, inflation and depression. So the third part of the course will deal with the business cycle. And we'll be focusing on the Austrian business cycle theory, and we'll be comparing it to the Keynesian theory, and also to what monetarists think about business cycles. Monetarists don't believe in business cycles. Okay, they just believe if you keep the money supply stable or slowly growing, that you can abolish business cycles. But of course, this hasn't happened. Okay. So what we're going to do then is to look at what Mises, Rothbard, and Hayek. Okay, three of the greatest business cycle theorists in economic thought, what they thought caused the business cycle. And it was Mises that really discovered that the interest rate was the key. And the central bank manipulation of the interest rate, or even fractional reserve banks, when we didn't have central banks, fractional reserve banks, manipulation of the interest rate, by creating more money, they would push interest rate down, and that would induce the entrepreneurs to borrow more money, to invest more money. But once that money was paid out in wages, the workers would continue to spend the same proportion of their income on consumer goods. So price of consumer goods would go up again, okay? And what would happen is that people wouldn't save that new money. Most, as I said, would be spent on consumer goods. So savings would shrink, and then there would not be enough money saved and available for the entrepreneurs to continue those long-run capital goods projects. And that's when the business cycle would, or rather the recession would hit. The problem, of course, today is that with central banks, they can keep pumping in more money and maintaining the low interest rate so that entrepreneurs can keep borrowing and borrowing, and as we see, when we, from 2001 to 2005, they could create enormous bubbles. Okay, so we had an enormous housing bubble, we had a stock bubble in the stock market, and when interest rates were pushed up, when the rate of money creation was slowed down, interest rates went from 1% up to 6%, 2005, 2006, the housing bubble popped, the stock market crashed, and we had this horrible financial crisis that ensued. And that also occurred in the 90s. I mean, they never learned, right? We were told in 1995 by Greenspan that we had a new economy, he called it, that suddenly we became more productive, okay, because of technological advances. And that as a result that the stock market rising as it did in the late 90s, especially in the tech area, was very wholesome. Okay? But then, of course, it crashed, and we had a recession in 2001. But the same thing happened with the housing bubble. Right at the end, 2004, 2005, Greenspan was denying that there was any sort of a bubble. He said something like, there is no bubble. Even if there was a bubble, we wouldn't know it. And even if we did know that there was a bubble, we couldn't do anything about it. Okay, so how's that for someone who's supposed to be running our money supply? Okay, this sort of total ignorance. And by the way, Milton Friedman, during that whole period from 2001 to 2006, thought that Greenspan was doing a great job, and later in the course I'll bring in some of his quotations on this, and thought that the American economy had overcome from about the late 80s, it was called the Great Moderation, from the late 80s to the early, to 2006, Friedman died late 2006. The last interview he gave was in December on the Charlie Rose television show. And even on that show, he claimed everything was great and that we had finally learned, he now trusted the central bank. That's what he said. He said in the last 15 years he had come to trust the central bank, which he never really did before. And he really praised Greenspan as the person who figured out how to manipulate the money supply. So this is Milton Friedman, who had said earlier on in his career that you don't want the central bank manipulating the money supply. You want to get rid of them and just have the Treasury increase the money supply and have a computer in the Treasury and have them increase the money supply at a very slow and steady rate, 3% a year. But he thought that things were going so well that he actually reneged on his own, repudiated his own earlier monetarist position, and was now in favor of sort of this manipulation of the money supply. So so Friedman was also sort of implicated in all of this. Not that he was a policymaker, so I don't want to put the blame on him. But certainly Bernanke and Greenspan were absolutely at fault for all of this. And it was really the only New Austrian economist, as it was in the 20s, okay, it was once again in the last decade, who began to predict on the basis of Austrian business cycle theory that there was a big housing bubble in the making and that it couldn't be sustained. So Peter Schiff, who took his cue from Austrian business cycle theory, was predicting it in 2003. Mark Thornton, who's here at the Mises Institute, made predictions in 2003. I myself, in 2004, I hadn't realized this, but I went back and looked at an article that I wrote on Greenspan. In late 2004, I said there was a housing bubble and that it was very close to bursting. Not that I'm a big predictor. But I mean, I just think Austrian economists in general were able, through their theory, through correct theory, to forecast not the exact timing of anything, but sort of the pattern that when you have the bubble and it's a result of very, very loose monetary policy, you're going to have the bust. And so we see today that we're beginning to get a run-up in the prices of land in the Midwest, agricultural land. Obviously, the price of gold has risen. I mean, it's leveled off a little bit, but there's a bubble in gold. Some people talk about it. It's probably not a bubble. That's probably sustainable because eventually we're going to see, I think, the dollar begin to crack. Okay, but also housing prices in certain markets now are beginning to run up, and of course the stock market has come way back almost to its overvalued level of over $14,000. Maybe it exceeded it for a while a few weeks ago. I'm talking about the Dow Jones. So the index. Right. I'll stop here, and I will take questions. I'll answer the questions that appear in the box here. So. Here's a question. Who, if anyone, financially supported Irving Fisher's career? Curious if any of the industrialists were supporting him since he was a price stabilizer. Fisher was very, very well known. He did move in the circles of industry. There's a great biography of Fisher, a two-volume biography by Robert Allen called, get the name of it now, but Irving Fisher is in the title. And he goes through a lot of these details. A curiosity that Irving Fisher was the one who invented the Rolodex, okay, where people kept their business cards before the internet. Okay, you keep them on the Rolodex. So he was very involved in industry, and there were a lot of businessmen that followed him, he gave a lot of investment advice. But as far as the interests, I'm not the special interests that supported Fisher. I'm not sure about that. Okay. I have another question here. I struggle with this concept. Is money store of value? Since store of value is not mentioned in our readings, I would say no, money is not a store of value. Money represents the ratio of prices to other goods and services. To imply that money is a store of value would imply intrinsic value to fiat currency. That's a very good question. Money, in fact, is a store of value. However, it's at the subsidiary or derivative function of money. Money, as Menger pointed out, as all Austrians hold, is a medium of exchange. But remember, people don't spend money as soon as they get it. That would mean that money doesn't have any value. Okay, so what people do is typically is they spend some money right away, and then they'll put a lot aside. They'll save some, which means to invest in assets, and they'll spend some on consumption, but they'll keep some in their checking accounts and in cash. And while they're waiting to see what else that they may desire, they want to spend. So money definitely is a store of value. Okay. That's not its defining function, but it's certainly an implication of the fact that money is a medium of exchange. So when you exchange for money, you don't intend to spend it right away. You intend to hold on to at least some of it. There's a question about what do you predict now? Any idea on how long we will have until the next crash? It's very difficult to predict. I know Bob Murphy, for example, predicted that we would have 10% year-over-year inflation in at least 1 month before 2013, and he was wrong on that. And we'll talk a little bit about those types of inflation and why it hasn't broken out. I wouldn't predict anything right now. What I will tell you is this, and that is that what's holding the dollar up, despite all the inflation, is the fact that the euro is cracking up, and that the yen is in the dumps. People don't trust the yen because of the huge debt that the Japanese government has, and the deficit continues to run. So really, the U.S. currency is the only safe haven. The RMB of China is not yet considered a currency that people want to hold in great amounts. So that's what's holding the dollar up. Now, once price inflation breaks out with the dollar, what you're going to see is people beginning to unload the dollar, the Chinese threatened to do a year or two ago. That is, sell the dollar on foreign markets. The value of the dollar will fall, and then you'll have a run away from the dollar. Okay, and at that point, we'll get high price will rise and interest rates will rise as foreign investors pull out their cash out of their investments out of the U.S. So that's sort of my prediction. Now, you know, that might happen in 2 years. I mean, I think that's a possibility. One other thing I wanted to mention about that, and that is that if we did have inflation breaking out, what I fear the most is that the U.S. government might try to fight it by reimposing wage and price controls. I wouldn't put it past that, because it would mean that the Keynesian solution has completely failed. They've pumped in all this money. Krugman and his ilk have told us that this is going to cure things. We have a huge debt. We're still running huge deficits. So all the things that Keynes told us that we should do when we have high unemployment, as we do today, will not have worked. And to get inflation on top of that will mean that the ruling elites, including the people that run the Fed and so on, will respond in a way that will wreck the economy. That is through wage and price controls. I mean, remember, a Republican president did that in 1971, Richard Nixon. Okay, someone asked, what role, if any, has the church or religion played in debasement of currencies through the ages? I don't know for sure, but many of the scholastics, for example, were against the debasement of money, that is, the clipping of coins, either making them smaller by shaving the edges of them, or putting them in bags and shaking them, which is called sweating the coins, and then the extra the filings that were left over would be turned into coins by the minted into new coins by the king, and he would give them out to his cronies, build new palaces, fight more wars, and so on. And the scholastics who were proto-Austrians, especially the Spanish scholastics, were very, very anti-debasement. And you might want to look at Guido Hulsman's book called The Ethics of Money Production to get a good answer to that question. There's a question here. Why do capital goods prices go up during the crisis? Shouldn't they go down because demand falls? I read it in one of Rothbard's papers. Well, in fact, capital goods prices do fall during depressions. Commodities prices collapse. You have oil prices falling. You have factories and so on. Construction. Okay, we had that during the collapse. Construction prices fall. And so that you do have capital goods prices falling during the during any sort of a bust or a recession, okay? And that's needed because too much money has been diverted into producing these long-term projects that cannot be completed with the available voluntary savings. It's asked here, do Austrians account for the effects of non-monetary barter transactions in the economy? If so, how? I don't think non-monetary barter transactions at this point in time, okay, are very important in our economy, okay? Now, in the U.S. economy, possibly in Italy or some high-tax, very, very high-tax countries, that may be the case. In hyperinflation economies, that's the case. For example, in Argentina in 1999 and 2000, what people were doing domestic dealers of Ford automobiles were being taught how to sell their cars for futures contracts in wheat and so on. And farmers were holding on to their grains and bartering them for the capital goods that they needed for their farms or for consumer goods. I think in times of great trouble is when you need to pay more attention to these barter transactions. But I don't think in the U.S. today we really need to do that yet. In fact, that's why the government's trying to get rid of the U.S. government, and especially many governments in Europe are trying to crack down on cash. Because you can use cash. I mean, as long as it's not hyperinflation, you can hide your transactions through cash. So if you'll note, the highest denomination bill that we have in the U.S. today is only $100, okay? Up until 1964, we had, I believe, $1,000 bills, $500 bills. If you compare the purchasing power of $100 today to the purchasing power of $100 in 1970, 1970, you'll find that in today's purchasing power of a $20 bill is, I'm sorry, I meant a $100 bill, excuse me. The purchasing power of a $100 bill, which is the biggest bill that we have today, is $16.80 or something like that, compared to its purchasing power in 1970. So really, our bills are very, very small. The government doesn't want to allow us to have bills with a lot of purchasing power because it's easier to hide big transactions. In Europe, the biggest bill is 500 euros, so many drug dealers are getting rid of dollars and doing their transactions in euros, which the bills are bigger, so you have to carry less of them. It's more convenient. Someone asked that about the Fed buying of government securities, which increases the money supply, but as these securities are paid off, that would seemingly reduce the money supply. Does the Fed have to constantly buy new securities even if they want to maintain a constant money supply? So, as the Fed turns in securities to be nominally paying off the principal by the Treasury, the Fed will replace them by buying new Treasury securities. So that's the way they do it. And then someone asked, what current economists, historians are researching the very earliest days of banking prior to the 17th century ancient times? What books would you recommend? Off the top of my head, I'm not sure about what book to recommend on that. You might want to look at some of the works of Larry White, who is very interested in Austrian, is very interested in the banking question. He happens to be a fractional reserve banker, and I tend to disagree with him on some issues, but he's very, very good on the history of banking. So you might want to look for some of the references in his books. I think I missed something.
In the chat or the Q&A? Where is this? This is the Q&A?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because they keep scrolling down.
This one does?
Yeah. Okay. Someone asks. Austrians critique economic models as being scientism. For economic science, I agree, these equations cannot establish praxeological truths. What about in finance? Are these models helpful if administered with care? I don't think that they are helpful in finance. In fact, a lot of these models were used by hedge funds and by other sorts of firms and so on. And they lost their shirts, okay, because the models can't capture changes in the structure of the economy. They can't capture changes in expectations about things. So I don't think that they're warranted. Their use is warranted in finance either. Someone asked, what are more modern terms for the roundaboutness of production? I think I would just call it the structure of production or the capital structure. But if you want a term that sort of captures what roundaboutness of production means, I think you could talk about the length of the production process. You don't have to use roundaboutness. What von Bauwerk was trying to do when he used that term was to point out, which people was new to people, that if you take a longer time to produce a good, in many cases you can find processes that are more productive than shorter processes. And there's some confusion there because he wasn't saying that all longer processes of production are more productive than the shorter ones. In fact, what he meant was that people always take the shortest route to their goals to begin with. So what's left over then are longer processes of production. So it's sort of a grid. Murray Rothbard draws a grid. So what you want is you want high productivity, short and long processes of production. Okay. You'll prefer a longer process of production if it's more productive or if it's productive enough relative to a shorter process. Okay. We'll talk more about that when we get to the structure of production, which I will talk about. Someone writes that they've heard Rothbard repeatedly refer to the value of paradox, but that's really the value paradox. Is this really called a paradox of value? It can be called, it's really the paradox of value. It's rarely called the value paradox. So I would stick to the term paradox of value. That's the way it appears in all textbooks. Okay, and of course that refers to the so-called diamond water paradox. The classical economists basically ask the question, why is it if, say they use bread instead of water, if bread is so valuable to human beings in the sense that it keeps them useful to human beings because it keeps them alive and nourishes them and so on, why is it that diamonds are more expensive? They couldn't answer that question given their flawed value theory, which is a cost of production theory. So they basically said, well, there's two kinds of value. There's use value, which, of course, bread and water have more use value than diamonds, but economics is concerned with use value. So they just completely threw that out. Economics is only concerned with exchange value. So we explain exchange value, the classical economists said, by simply pointing out that, look, diamonds cost more to produce than bread, the bread cost to produce, and that's why the price is higher. But the Austrians, starting with Karl Menger in 1871, showed that that wasn't a good answer. That was a completely false answer. That use and exchange value can and should be integrated. In fact, I taught a class today at Auburn University, introductory class, and I asked the students if diamonds were more valuable than water, and of course they all said yes. And then, but again, it depends on conditions. It depends on what people think about their wants and given the conditions that they're in. So if you have a diamond, and by the way, there was a famous incident in which Kobe Bryant, the basketball player I mentioned before, had a sort of a bout of infidelity with his wife. So to make up with her, he bought a $10 million purple diamond, very rare, very expensive. If you were in a desert for 3 days and hadn't had access to water, would you part with this diamond? Would you trade the $10 million diamond for a jug of water if you came across someone with water? Of course you would. So in that instance, in those conditions, the individual values the diamond. It has greater use value and a greater exchange value to him. I'm sorry, the water has a greater use value, greater exchange value to him together than the diamond. So both use value and exchange value go together. Someone asked, basic economics teaches that savings equal investment. So the greater the savings, the more investments. How do Keynesians get around this or ignore it? They seem to have no interest in savings. Their position seems to be almost exactly in opposition to S equal I. Well, believe it or not, Keynesians believe that S is always equal to I, that it's an identity, that they can't be any different. But what Keynes means by that is that, when investment falls, okay, let's say you don't have enough spending, okay? So if you don't have enough spending, people spend less, so then savings will fall and consumption will fall. And as savings falls, it then pulls down investment and pulls down spending, okay? So if people try to save, that's called the paradox of saving, according to Keynes, or the paradox of thrift, actually, they call it. So when people try to save more, they wind up actually saving less and investing less. Okay, that's a paradox. And the paradox is explained by the fact that if you try to save more, all you wind up doing is cutting down on the amount of consumption. And when you have less consumption, you have less people buying goods and services, so people's incomes fall. And when people's incomes fall, they actually wind up saving less and consuming less. Okay, so that's the paradox of saving. Oh, and just to finish up on that, what Austrians and other classical economists believed is that, look, if as long as savings increases, it's going to put a downward pressure on the interest rate, and see the fall in the interest rate is going to induce more investment. So as a result of people's actions and an economic process that you get saving and investing being equal. They're not automatically equal. Keynes claimed that after everything collapses, when people try to save more, then you have very low savings and very low investment, and they're equal at this very low level. Okay, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's what he believes. Okay, so I'm going to ask, how great of an impact is inflation on economic calculation? Has a very great impact, at least high inflation has a very great impact. What happens is that it's very difficult to account to do accounting that doesn't record things that a business buys at historical price. So if you buy 10 machines and they're $1 million each, so it's $10 million. And they're going to wear out in 10 years, or let's say 5 years, and wear out in 5 years. So you're going to put aside over time, if they're $1 million, you spend, let's say you put aside $10 million to replace them 5 years later. Well, if prices in the meantime have doubled to $20 million, you only have enough money to replace half of your capital. Okay, you can only replace five of those machines, so your business shrinks. Okay, so inflation distorts economic calculation. Now, economists and accountants have tried to come up with ways of recording things at replacement cost, but you never know really going to know what the replacement cost will be in the future, okay, under a rapid inflation. Someone also asks about the news. Lately in the news, certain politicians and economists, including Krugman, okay, I thought you said economists there, have been discussing minting a $1 trillion platinum coin to deal with the debt issue. Can you discuss your thoughts on the consequences of this inane idea? You know, I've heard of this. I haven't read really deeply about it. I just heard 2 days ago that this was the case. I'm not exactly sure how that would get them around the debt issue, but I'll look at it more next week and ask you the same question next week. I'm not sure what Krugman is actually proposing there. There's a question whether I've read David Graeber's book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. I haven't seen it, but it sounds interesting. I'll look at it on Amazon, see what it's all about. Thanks. Someone asked, are there examples in the world of countries that are not destroying the integrity of their currency? Well, there are some countries that are trying not to do so. I mean, Switzerland is one. They're trying. I mean, obviously, they went off the gold standard, so right there you breached the integrity of your currency. But the Swiss franc has been appreciating. Recently, though, they've tried to keep it from appreciating because it's really hurting their export industries. Which means in order to do that, they have to buy up dollars. And to do that, they have to create more Swiss francs. So we're, in effect, exporting our inflation to both Switzerland and also to China, which is trying to keep its currency cheap and therefore buying up our dollars. Other countries, for example, have, like Ecuador and I think El Salvador, have dollarized. They've gotten rid of their own inflationary currencies, and they just simply use U.S. dollars now because they're less inflationary. But again, they're directly importing our inflation. So when a country dollarizes, it becomes just like another state. It becomes like Pennsylvania or Alabama. That is, its price level will move in sync with the price level of U.S. states. So they become sort of an economic, the economic point of view, one of the states in the U.S. It's a good question on what the long-term consequences of the Fed tying its policies to employment levels versus price levels. That is old-fashioned Keynesianism. Okay, again, the Keynesians don't believe that money directly affects prices. So what they wanted, they talked about the Phillips curve, and that you can lower unemployment. You have to buy, they call buying some inflation, okay? So you have to inflate a little bit, but you can lower unemployment by doing that. But the Keynesians today are even more radical than that, because they're basically saying that no inflation will break out. It's sort of free. You don't have to have any additional inflation to get us more, to get us less unemployment. They really believe that we can keep pumping dollars in and keep running deficits, and in that way, bring down the unemployment rate. Now, what that did in the 1920s, that's the way we operated in the 60s, and what it did into the 70s, and what it did was to bring about a great deflation, okay, which could be a result today also. That is, we had continued to have high unemployment rates, but inflation rates were also high. And that was the death, originally, of the old Keynesian economics, okay. But now, as I said, it's come back. And it's come back with a vengeance. And so this whole idea of tying your monetary policy to a real variable like unemployment is just a recipe for stagflation again. Someone asked, is the CPI an accurate measure of price inflation anymore? They hear about how CPI has been changed dramatically to avoid volatile goods like food and energy. We hear that inflation is well under control from the Fed, but no one who buys anything agree. And I agree with you. CPI, they've watered it down. They've taken out housing. Okay, they put in imputed rents, which are much lower than you know, housing prices, at least in the run-up of the bubble. Right, they've taken out volatile goods. They've done other things. There's something called hedonic adjustments. And what they do there is, let's say the price of a new car goes up by 10%, but the new car has side airbags. So they'll just arbitrarily say, well, the quality's increased too, as well as the price, so you can't really take the whole price increase. So because part of that increase is to make the car better. And so you're no worse off with, let's say, the car is a better buy. So so you would expect the price to go up. So we'll subtract, let's say, 5%. So we'll say the price of the car has really gone up by 5%, not 10. Because 10% represents the quality, the increased quality of the car. So the hedonic adjustments, hedonic, H-E-D-O-N-I-C, adjustments are also a way of sort of distorting the CPI. There's nothing sacred about the CPI. It was always a flawed figure, but as Murray Rothbard always pointed out, you should keep that figure. I mean, you shouldn't change it continually. Okay, and they're always changing the direction of showing lower and lower inflation. Okay, and there's there's an individual who runs this website called Shadow Stats, in which he calculates CPI today as it would have been calculated in the 1970s, and he comes up with much higher inflation rates than we're getting today. Someone asked, is the ideal of the gold standard relevant anymore to modern economies? We get smaller and smaller coins in the UK. Also, how close the Austrian ideal is, and just skip it. We get smaller and smaller coins in the UK. Also, how close the Austrian ideal is Cameron's conservative government? Unemployment seems to be going down. Are we in a bubble in the UK? I'm not as familiar with the statistics in the UK, so I couldn't say if you were in a bubble. I do think that the gold standard is relevant to modern economy still. I don't think you can go back by having the government reinstitute the gold standard, though. I wouldn't trust them to do that. I think the first step back to a commodity money, to a market money, is to get rid of all taxes on gold and silver, sales taxes, excise taxes, capital gains taxes, get rid of any regulations against holding foreign, like we have in the U.S., holding foreign currency bank accounts in U.S. banks, okay? And let's have competition. This is what Hayek pointed out. Let's have competition among currencies, okay? So that people choose whether they want to hold gold, silver, Swiss franc, or the rotten U.S. dollar. Uh, Someone asked, why hasn't the unemployment rate today responded to all the current QE, quantitative easing? Is it that businesses are exhibiting new and unexpected behavior in response to Fed action compared to the past? Well, I think you've hit the right, you've hit very close to the mark there. Businesses are afraid to invest. They're afraid to invest because of what's called regime uncertainty. That is, they're uncertain about what the politicians are going to do, to put it bluntly, including the central bank. Okay? They don't know how much Obamacare is going to cost, so they're very hesitant to hire new workers. So the unemployment rate is staying high for that. They're not going to. They're not sure about how the government's going to deal with the first the debt ceiling, and then after that the debt itself. Whether they're going to try to raise taxes in order to do that. So and also they're not sure about what the Fed's going to be doing in the future. So it's not a good environment for investment. So you are right. The entrepreneurs and the investors are holding back until they are a little bit more sure about what's developing. Someone asked if the introduction of hedonics and other monkeying with the definition of CPI directly imply the Keynesians know their system is a failure. Yeah, I would say that they do, and they want to at least the policy making changes. They want to hide it from the American public. On the other hand, these people really do have a vested interest in their beliefs. I mean, once people get out of graduate school, they tend to not want to change their minds anymore. I mean, they've invested all this time and energy, and their academic reputations in promoting a certain view. For example, Krugman or Brad DeLong. And they're going to keep saying that nothing wrong with our programs, is that you haven't done enough of it. They can always say that, okay? And that's exactly what they're doing today. Someone asked if it is an odd that the politicians that embrace Keynes have a globalist that since Keynesian policies export our inflation. Okay, well, that's the whole point. What the U.S. wants is, for example, they're browbeating China to let its currency appreciate. Okay, so that Chinese goods become more expensive. What we're trying to do is to export our unemployment now. That is, we want their goods to be more expensive so that Americans buy our goods, okay, and rather it shifts away from buying Chinese goods, and that means that there'll be more employment generated in the U.S. This was something, it was called beggar thy neighbor policies, which occurred during the 1930s, which almost put a complete standstill to international trade. Every major country tried to lower the value of their currency in terms of the currencies of other countries, but of course the other countries responded, so no one got anywhere with it. Yeah, okay, someone asked why we haven't seen large inflation following QE. Well, we haven't seen large inflation in consumer prices, but we've certainly seen the inflation, reinflation of the stock market, reinflation of commodities prices, agricultural land, as I said before, in parts of the U.S. is shooting up. And I recently heard that in the Bay Area, for example, housing prices are going up. So, in fact, it's just coming out in other areas, okay? Also, because we are getting cheaper goods from foreign countries, the consumer price index is staying down for that reason also. And someone asked here, what do you see would be the global ramifications for the U.S. if it ever loses its veto power in the IMF? The IMF is really a creation of the U.S. and Great Britain. Great Britain is no longer a big player in the world. The U.S. completely controls the IMF. It funds it, and therefore it controls it. You know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So I don't ever see that happening. I mean, we are the IMF. It's sort of the U.S. economic, global economic policy on. Okay, it carries out our policies abroad.
Okay. All right, well, thank you, Dr. Salerno. Just for anybody who's new to the Mises Academy courses, it takes a little while for us to process the recording. So we're going to process it and turn it into an MP4 video and an MP3 audio file. And once those are ready, we'll post them. But it might take a day, maybe 2 days, to get it processed. And but even before it's processed, we'll be able to post the WebEx version of the recording. So the WebEx is sort of, WebEx has its own proprietary format. When you load a WebEx recording, it will automatically try to download the program that you need to play it. And we'll also be, we already posted the slides, so that's already available on the course page. And we'll be posting the chat transcript and the Q&A transcript as well. And so feel free to talk in the general forum. Thank you, Dr. Salerno. And we will see you all next week.
Good evening. Have a good evening. Good night.